Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Iran says the U.S. government bears ultimate international responsibility for the 2020 assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The U.S. and Russian presidents exchange warnings during a phone call amid escalating tensions over Ukraine. And Palestinian journalists accuse Facebook of pro-Israel bias as they complain about what they call unjust suppression of their content. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. Iran says the U.S. bears ultimate international responsibility for the 2020 assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Tehran says the Criminal and Terrorist Act will not go unpunished and pledges to continue efforts to bring to justice the perpetrators. Iran says the assassination of Lieutenant General Soleimani sent a message of support to terror groups and exposed U.S. lies that it fights terrorism worldwide. Iran says Soleimani was an anti-terror hero who helped promote peace and stability in the region and elsewhere in the world. January the 3rd marks the anniversary of the assassination of top Iranian General Soleimani, along with senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were killed in a drone attack near Baghdad. On that story, let's bring in Mr. Farazan Najim. He's a human rights activist who actually joins us via Skype out of Ottawa. He's also with the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. Mr. Najim, thank you very much for joining us. Tell us what you think about the piece that I just read.
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah. It was a very good statement by the Iranian government, because clearly Qasem Soleimani was invited to Iraq. There was a security agreement between Iraq and Iran, and he was working in coordination with the forces inside Iraq. He worked, on a big project of destroying ISIS, this big terrorist, network that was disrupting, the Middle East, and also was destabilizing all of Iraq, and was a danger to, Iraq from every corner. And he helped dismantle and destroy this terrorist organization. And right after he finished and he was successful and completed this project, USA comes inside and kills this man and his partner as well, and ally Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, these both great generals that saved the world. They worked for world peace, not just Iraq or for Iran. And this shows clearly that the U.S. is behind the terrorism, and they're also the supporters of terrorism, and that they want more terrorism in the region, because this was what really it helps their benefit and interest in controlling the region and securing their allies and securing Israel. And that's the main reason why they support these terrorist groups. They don't have to publicly say that they support these groups, but by this act of killing Qasem Soleimani, and also breaching international law, and showing disregard to any law by even killing them near a civilian airport. This is the central airport of Iraq, the Baghdad airport, where airplane. Who can just think that they can commit an act like this and just kill somebody beside an airport and blow cause an explosion? I mean, what would the U.S. think if somebody was to do that in the U.S. and cause an explosion near an American airport? So this shows clearly they have no respect for any laws, any agreements between countries. They think they're above the law. And Iran must work hard with Iraq to prosecute these criminals. The Trump administration, Pompeo, all these criminals that were involved in this act, and make sure that justice is served, because this cannot be forgotten or forgiven, because this will give a green light for further attacks and criminal acts by the U.S. with other Greek personalities such as these people. So this should be really taken serious. This should be followed, and there should be, files also presented to the United Nations in different areas as well.
Tell me, Firas and Najim, what do you think about the fact, or about fact or notion, you'll be the judge of that, that's how the U.S. wants to display itself in the world arena, to be the one country or the one side who is against terrorism. But actually, with acts like this, do you think there is enough room for justification that we were fighting against terrorists by killing someone who has actually been the pillar of fighting against terrorism in this area of the world?
I mean, it's just clear hypocrisy. It's contradiction to what they promote, and they try to present to the world that they stand for. And I'm actually thankful that the U.S. Shows and reveals its true nature by doing such acts. You know, we're sad that this act happened, obviously, and we lost such a great person that was an asset to the whole world, because he was working to expand this project of fighting terrorism all the way, through the whole Middle East. And I think that he was very near, destroying the biggest terrorist state that we have, and that's Israel. The resistance in Palestine have really, really received a lot of assistance from Qasem Soleimani, and most of the leadership inside Palestine have, gave the credit to Qasem Soleimani that he's helped bring into Palestine. So pretty much, it just clearly shows the contradiction, the hypocrisy, and the lies that the U.S. presents to the world. And, we need prosecution, we need accountability, we need justice for these kind of cases. We can never let these things go, because we've seen almost World War III happen. If it was not for the great leadership and the wisdom of Sayyid Khamenei and the rest of the Iranian armed forces and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, there could have been World War III, but they were, very vigilant, and they were, restrained, and how they responded as well. You know, they could have set the whole region on fire if they wanted to. They had the right as well to, strike back and hit the U.S. bases in the Middle East, because this act was committed by the bases, right? The drones were flying from Kuwait or from Qatar or one of these countries. So pretty much Iran had the right to respond and hit these bases, and that would have maybe set off the whole region. But Iran was patient and made the right move, and I think that, they are going to do the right decisions in the future as well.
Many, many thanks. That's Mr. Firas and Najim, human rights activist, the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights out of Ottawa via Skype. I really appreciate your time, sir. The U.S. says it's concerned about Iran's new space launch, arguing that the launch would help the country's missile program. Washington says the technology used in the space launch vehicle is similar to those used in ballistic missiles. It also says Iran's space launches violate the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the 2015 Iranian deal. Tehran rejects that. It says its missile program is an issue separate from the 2015 accord and is meant for defense purposes. It had successfully sent three research payloads into space. The country carried out the launch using a domestically made satellite carrier rocket. Iran said the payload reached an altitude of 470 kilometers. Earlier, we reached out to political commentator Alexander Azatgan. He believes Iran's advances in its space program is the real reason behind the U.S. concern.
Well, the Iranians have said this is a satellite capability, and Iran is only, there are only 10 nations who have this capability. So the advancement is domestic, which is why they're petrified of it. In other words, Iran doesn't have to rely on anybody. That's why they're absolutely frightened of this. This is a psychological warfare for the minds and hearts of the people around the world to demonize Iran, to petrify everybody of Iran. Every single IAEA report and inspection has confirmed that Iran did stay within its legitimate lines, and it did not violate its commitments in any shape or form.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says there has been relatively good progress in negotiations aimed at restoring the 2015 deal or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ali Bagheri-Kani says the talks have been focused on the removal of U.S. sanctions. From Vienna, Homa Lezgi reports.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani, says there's been relatively good progress over the past few days in the negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
The main focus of the negotiations was sanctions removal. We had several meetings with the EU coordinator and the three European signatories, both on verification and guarantees.
Iran says it will go back to its nuclear commitments only after it verifies the full removal of US sanctions. Tehran has also demanded guarantees that the US will not withdraw from the JCPOA again or impose sanctions that violate the deal. A European source close to the negotiations says all participants agree that verification and assurances have to be reflected in the final document, but that there are still questions on how that is possible. So are these issues going to create major obstacles in the way of a final agreement?
Yes, it's a major problem because these European diplomats know quite well how verification can take place. It's not something strange. If the Iranians cannot use the banking system because behind the scenes the Americans are threatening banks, then that's a violation of the JCPOA.
Russia's lead delegate Mikhail Olyanov said he believed an agreement could be achieved in the first half of February, adding that although the discussions were difficult, there was steady progress.
General impression, business-like atmosphere, positive trends recognized by everybody, by all participants. We need to be patient, persistent in our efforts, and we will overcome all the problems.
Informal consultations are set to continue within the framework of the Vienna talks. The eighth round will resume after a three-day break for the New Year holidays on Monday. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
To another one of our headline stories, Russia warns the U.S. that any further sanctions against Moscow would threaten their bilateral ties. Speaking on the phone, Russian President Vladimir Putin tells his American counterpart, Joe Biden, that introducing more bans would be a colossal mistake. Biden, for his part, warns Russia of a decisive response in case Moscow invades Ukraine. The 50-minute-long call is the second time the two leaders spoke directly to one another in just over 3 weeks. The West accuses Moscow of planning to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the accusation, arguing that its military buildup along its border is a means of protection against NATO's eastward expansion. Officials from the two countries will hold security talks over the issue in January. Political commentator Mr. William Jones says the U.S. desire to remain the single rulemaker in the world explains its attitude toward Russia.
They're still in the mode of really slicing up Russia and preventing it from becoming what it has become, in the process of becoming a great power. The United States has the view, based really on this Anglo-American doctrine, that we have to make the rules of the road, and that other countries, be it China, be it Russia, especially those that don't have this Anglo-American twist, are not the ones who are going to make the rules. This is the old geopolitical doctrines of Karl Haushofer and Mackinder, and these guys are being followed by the United States. The fact that Putin took the initiative to make this call, I think, is also a significant sign of the danger, because I think he was coming to a point, in spite of the fact that there are some talks that are going to be going on in January with regard to all these issues, that he felt that the U.S. was moving so forcefully in the direction of the red line that cannot be overstepped without a military conflict.
The major Muslim American advocacy group in the U.S. revealed two spying incidents against the Muslim community earlier this month, with the cases uncovered within days. The Council on American Islamic Relations says one incident involved the head of its Ohio branch. The council, known as CARE, says it sacked the man on December the 15th after finding that he had passed confidential information to an anti-Muslim group. The same group was again named a week later. That's when an individual volunteering at a mosque told the council that he'd been paid to provide information on the Muslim community. CARE believes that the spying is aimed at creating fear and distrust among Muslims in the U.S. The council says it'll step up efforts to battle Islamophobia. Apart from spying, Muslim Americans in the past two decades have been subjected to discriminatory policies, including travel bans. In our third headline story, Palestinian journalists are raising the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on social media giant Facebook. The journalists have cited several incidents to back their claim. One of them says Facebook has deleted his video showing Israeli forces shooting dead a Palestinian on the ground. An online Palestinian outlet says Facebook has deleted its page with 1.2 million followers. In 2021 alone, Facebook restricted or deleted 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian posts. That's according to a Palestinian social media monitoring center. Meanwhile, international rights organizations have previously spoken out against Facebook for suppressing content about Israeli rights violations. The social platform's parent company, Meta, rejects the accusations. It says it's only trying to keep Facebook safe by removing harmful content. The COVID pandemic wreaks havoc across Europe amid a rapid surge in cases fueled by the spread of the Omicron variant. The UK reports more than 189,000 new daily infections, an all-time high since the start of the pandemic. It also registers 332 more deaths. Italy marks a fresh daily record in cases, logging nearly 127,000 infections. In France, the new cases surpassed the 200,000 mark for the second straight day. Meanwhile, the number of cases in Germany still remain high, with authorities reporting more than 109,000 new infections. And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be a verse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
ولقد يسرنا القرآن للذكر فهل من مدكر
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed explanation of Surah Zariyat, and from this Friday onwards we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Tur, which is number 52 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 49 ayahs. The surah derives its name from Tur, or the mount. More specifically, the Mount of Sinai, on which God Almighty revealed the Torah to Prophet Moses. The surah thus opens with the divine oath by the Mount Sinai to signify its sacredness. It addresses many of the arguments put forth by the pagan Arabs of Mecca to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The torment of hell for the disbelievers is contrasted by the bliss of paradise for the true believers. The Prophet is commanded by God to continue delivering the universal message of Islam in the face of the opposition by the disbelievers, and to await divine judgment, which is inevitable. According to a hadith from the Prophet, the one who recites Surah Tur shall be safe from torment and shall enjoy divine favors in paradise. Now we present you the first four ayahs of this surah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wat-Tur.
وكتاب مسطور في رق منشور والبيت المعمور.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. By the Mount Sinai, by the book inscribed on an unrolled parchment, by the house greatly frequented. The surah begins with several oaths, and in these first four ayahs, three divine oaths are mentioned. The first two divine oaths refer to Tur or Mount Sinai, and the divine book, which according to exegetes, is the one inscribed and preserved in Lohe Mahfuz, or the secure tablet in the celestial heavens, in an unrolled state and revealed to the last and greatest prophet as a universal message for the guidance of mankind in all ages. The third divine oath by the Beitul Ma'mur, or the much frequented house, according to exegetes, is the holy Kaaba in Mecca, which is always thronged by pilgrims, and more specifically the edifice in the celestial heavens for the worship of angels that can neither be desecrated by anyone nor deserted due to pandemics and strife as it happens on earth. According to the Prophet's vicegerent and first infallible successor, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the Beitul Ma'mur, or greatly frequented house in the heavens, is visited all the while by thousands of angels who circumambulate, pray, and then never come back again. In other words, it implies constant increase in the realm of creation. These ayahs teach us that, number one, oaths on the symbols of sacredness, including a book, and that too amongst both the ignorant and those claiming to be masters of speech, indicates the high value Islam attaches to writing and reading. Number two, it is incumbent upon believers to keep alive the glorious heritage of the prophets and their endeavors in enlightening humanity. And number three, the heavenly scripture revealed for the guidance of all mankind should be written in clear format on the best material and published in abundance to ensure proper distribution so that people have easy access to it. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 5, 6, 7 and 8 of the same surah.
والسقف المرفوع والبحر المسجور إن عذاب ربك لواقع ما له من دافع.
By the elevated roof, that is the sky, by the surging or blazing ocean, indeed, your Lord's punishment will surely befall. There is none who can avert it. In continuation of the previous ayahs regarding oaths by the divine signs, ayahs 5 and 6 take oath by two important factors of the world of creation. The first, the elevated roof, is reference to the sky or the canopy of heaven, to whose height or sublimity no limit can be assigned by the mind of man, which is unable to discover its mysteries despite advancement of science. The second divine oath by the Bahrul Masjur is a reference to the brimming, abounding, and agitated ocean where magma erupts through undersea volcanoes and which would be set ablaze on the Resurrection Day. Ayahs 7 and 8 refer to the divine punishment on the Day of Judgment that will surely afflict those who die in the state of disbelief, denial, and sins. There is no escape from divine wrath, and none can avert it. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, by contemplating on the divine signs which are manifest in the universe, we get a glimpse of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and His resurrecting of mankind on the Day of Judgment for rewards or punishment. And number two, the agonies one goes through during mortal life in our transient world are temporary and could be averted. While the punishment on the Day of Judgment for those who die in the state of disbelief, denial of truth, and unrepentant sins, despite the long respite given by the All-Merciful Lord, will be severe and inevitable. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 9, 10, 11, and 12 of Surah Tur in conclusion of this week's episode.
يَوْمَ تَمُورُ السَّمَاءُ مَوْرًا وَتَسِيرُ الْجِبَالُ سَيْرًا فَوَيْلٌ يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلْمُكَذِّبِينَ الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي خَوْضٍ يَلْعَبُونَ.
On the day when the sky reels violently and the mountains move with an awful motion, woe to the deniers on that day, those who play around in vain talk. These ayahs point to the situation of the earth and the sky on the threshold of resurrection, when the world of existence that has been created for the best of creation, that is, mankind, shall come to its end, along with the end of the worldly affairs of the human race. In other words, the material world shall be rolled up through a terrible shaking of the sky and the earth, when the seemingly mighty mountains move from their places as powerful earthquakes occur. It means the material world shall disintegrate upon divine will and change into the hereafter. Divine torment in store for those who deserve it is based upon order and justice. As is clear from ayahs 11 and 12, the day of reckoning will be a day of woe to the disbelievers who belied the signs of Allah, since every evil deed has its own retributive and punishable chain of consequences. Whatever is done in the transient life of the mortal world is a preparation for the hereafter, which the disbelievers will find a reality on the Day of Judgment, which they used to deny and mock by indulging in vain talk and sins, despite the warnings of the long line of prophets sent by God for guidance. As for the true believers, it will be a day of joy and bliss. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the massive upheaval of the material world will be the precursor for emergence of a new order for resurrection and the day of judgment. Number two, the deniers of the hereafter will find how irrational and baseless were their claims, but there is no repentance on that day. And number three, everything is based on justice by the all-merciful Lord who never wrongs anyone.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Since Modi has taken over the country in 2014 as prime minister, India has turned from an ethnically diverse society to one of less tolerant and increased violence. But why? What's the goal? Stay with us on this Spotlight.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target. That is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event which was held in the northern Indian city of Hyderabad from 17 to 19 December faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And the Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajare, out of Peshma.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, I'd like to start this off with Zafar. Thanks so much again for being with us. Do you think that the ruling party, BJP party, is specifically targeting Muslims? And if so, why would that be the case?
Absolutely. The ruling party's origins, and particularly those of Narendra Modi, are from a group called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. It's a fascist outfit. It has more than 6 million members, and their avowed aim is to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu society in which there is absolutely no room for other religious minorities, be they the 200 million Muslims or millions of Christians or even Dalits that constitute something like 200 million people. Basically, the BJP, the ruling party, operates at two levels. Number one, by polarizing the population, it believes that it can garner the support of the Hindu majority, which of course it is doing. But at the same time, it is beholden to these extremist groups that want to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu state, in which there is no room for minorities, and that is also being pursued. If we look at the record of Modi since he became the Prime Minister in 2014, we see an alarming rise in anti-Muslim attacks in all parts of India, particularly around Delhi, places like Gurgaon and other places. Muslims are not given permission to build mosques. They are being targeted either because there are cow vigilantes who accuse Muslims of slaughtering cows, which is considered a sacred animal in India, or even accusing Muslim vendors, small vendors, of installing their push carts on roadsides, accusing them of blocking traffic when in fact there are no such allegations or accusations made against Hindus. So there are two aspects to this whole campaign. Number one, that Modi and his henchmen have found that polarizing the society garners them support in India because it's a majority Hindu country anyway, and therefore they don't care for the other people. It's not in that sense a true democracy. And number two, there is a very, very strong and dangerous movement in India that wants to turn India into a Hindu state.
Okay.
And that movement is actually supported by the ruling party, and that's the frightening part of it.
All right. Well, Masood, your take. You heard what Zafar said. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of this country with the size of it, and we're talking about Muslim population over 200 million. If that is the case, if actually Modi or BJP, they really want to turn us into a Hindu nation, I mean, what does that mean? How do they think that that can be accomplished, just looking at the sheer numbers?
It's very dangerous. I'm afraid this has been going on for quite a long time. It's going back even sort of before the new government being sworn in. I mean, in Gujarat, we had under governorship of Modi sort of ethnic cleansing and clashes and massacres of Muslims, which never dealt with appropriately, neither internationally or nationally within India. And this sort of Hindutva movement, which is pushing the idea of otherization and sort of concentrating on demonizing anyone who is not Hindu, it's getting strength, and unfortunately, I have to say that it's out of control. We are not just it, which is been going on and has been going on for a very long time, but we are actually seeing legislation after legislation discriminating against the Muslims in India on citizenship and on even saying that any religious group could actually, from the neighboring country, could go to India and get sanctuary, except Muslims.
Right.
And so this exceptionalization against Muslims is going on, and I think international community, and indeed even the Muslim nations, are completely silenced to this demonization. And even there are number of token Muslim leaders who's actually part of BJP and promoting this. And also, just to throw in the situation of Kashmir, which is part of that sort of demonization of Muslims,
right,
and denying them the right, is again very obvious and very clear. Something needs to be done,
okay,
on a matter of urgency.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Masood said that something needs to be done. I want to look at starting inside of the country itself. I mean, India likes to call itself the largest democracy in the world. How did this legislation, for example, the citizenship law, actually pass? I mean, in a country that says it's democratic and then has this very extremist elements that is growing. Tell me about the inside of the country and how this is allowed to happen.
Well, basically, what the BJP is doing is, as you pointed out, that it is enacting laws through parliament, because the BJP has a majority in parliament, and this national citizenship law, which they have passed, which basically disenfranchises Muslims, and they can be essentially thrown out of the country. In fact, these are moves going on right now in India, in certain parts of India, that they are enacting. Then there are other aspects. In fact, the Indian constitution, for instance, says that all citizens have equal rights. But as far as the BJP is concerned, it does not believe in this. One of the BJP's leaders, Subramaniam Swamy, was being interviewed by Britain's Channel 4, and she asked him directly and said that your constitution says that all citizens have equal rights, so why are Muslims being persecuted? And Subramaniam Swamy openly said that we do not consider Muslims to be equal to Hindus, and therefore they cannot have equal rights. When you look at this situation, this is absolutely frightening, that they are actually instituting laws to discriminate against Muslims and to consider them as being alien to that country. In fact, these Hindu extremist groups have made absolutely no secret of the fact that the Muslims must either convert to Hinduism or they have to be killed, as this recent meeting of December 17th to 19th that took place in Haridwar in India, and they categorically stated that we need to arm ourselves, that we need to start to kill Muslims, and we need to eliminate these Muslims. And when you look at the fact that Narendra Modi hasn't even uttered a word of condemnation of this, speaks volumes that he is actually encouraging and supporting this kind of attitude and behavior. And I'm afraid, if serious action is not taken, first of all by Muslim countries, secondly by the larger international community, I am afraid that there is going to be a genocide of Muslims in India on such a horrendous scale that will boggle the mind. And I'm afraid this is where it is heading unless immediate action is taken.
Well, let's look at the international aspect to this, Masood. Do you see any action coming from the international community or Muslim communities? You talked about earlier that there is not enough being done. What is being done, and what do you think should be done?
Well, really, nothing positive has been done. I mean, we have seen that some of these Persian Gulf countries, like Bahrain and others, have actually awarded Modi with the highest award and recognition. It's outrageous that this is happening at the time that so openly, so publicly, so institutionally, Muslims are being demonized and to the extent that the slaughtering of them, it is really becoming very obvious that if nothing is happening, then we are going to see ethnic cleansing and genocide against Muslims. And let us remember that this is going long way back. I mean, colonial power, Britain in particular, were involved in this divide and rule policy, which actually has already once resulted in genocide of hundreds and millions of people in India in the partition time. And now this new ideology and Hindutva is an ideology which is fixed on ethnic cleansing, fixed on supremacy, and fixed on promoting this. And, it's been promoted systematically. Their supporters, the United States, are becoming powerful and locked by. And so I can't see anything is going to happen automatically. We need to bring awareness. And, India is going down a route which I think genocide and ethnic cleansing is just around the corner. Hmm. And I'm not being alarmist. This is actually what is happening. And even the Muslim world and countries are absolutely in daydreaming while this is taking place.
Well, Zafar, we know that India has been getting closer and closer to the Zionist regime, Israel. I mean, when hearing some of the things that you were saying, and also Masoud was saying, it was like out of the Israeli playbook, some of the issues that the Muslims are facing now in India. Your assessment of that, do you see any similarities to what is taking place and perhaps Israeli influence in this, or your assessment of that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. The Indian fascists, the Hindutva fascists, are actually following the Israeli model completely. What the Zionists are doing to the Palestinian people in Palestine, this is precisely what these Hindutva fascists are doing to Muslims in India, except that the scale is much larger in India, because in India we have at least 200 million Muslims. I would echo exactly what Masoud said, that these anti-Muslim pogroms and riots have been going on since day one of the creation of India. But since the BJP came to power, it has escalated alarmingly, because these fascist groups now have a state at their disposal. And let me give you some examples. For instance, the police force in India, in most parts of India, are infested by these Hindutva fascists. So when Muslims are being targeted, even if they go to lodge a complaint, the police don't pay any attention. You look at the latest example that happened on December 17th to 19th, when a complaint was lodged, although evidence was presented to the police that look at these Hindu fascists that are openly declaring that they should arm themselves and perpetrate a genocide against the Muslims, only one person has been charged out of an entire group of thousands that were involved in that. That gives you an indication of the level of infiltration that has taken place of these fascist elements. The same thing applies to the bureaucracy in India. You go everywhere and you see that today Muslims are first of all deprived of their economic rights, now they're being deprived of their political rights, and they're actually being killed, and very little is being done inside India. So we see that the playbook that the Zionists are following in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, is being repeated in India. I want to add one other point, and that is that India is now considered an ally of the United States and of the West in general, because they want to target China and they want to rope in India on their side. In the United States, there is an organization called the United States Commission for international religious freedom. For 2 years in a row, 2020 and 2021, this organization called upon the US State Department to say that India is a country of concern because of religious persecution of minorities, and the State Department should put it on its list. For 2 years in a row, the State Department has categorically refused to do so, claiming and stating that just because India is an ally, that we would not do such a thing. So I'm afraid we are facing a very, very serious situation whereby, regrettably, neither the Muslim countries nor the broader international community is going to do anything about it. And that is why I said that there is a very, very serious risk of a genocide of Muslims taking place in India.
A message you had mentioned, Kashmir, earlier, and again, when I talk about that comparison between what the Israeli regime is doing, and we look at what Kashmir, that situation, and how at one point in time they were able to keep their land and just other Muslims from the region could, but now Modi, with the law that was passed, actually allows anyone to go in there, and we see an unbelievable crackdown on Kashmir. My question is, do you think there is going to be blowback for all of this inside of India from what is being done in Kashmir, from what is being done inside of India to the minority communities in general? As Zafar had pointed out, the Muslims are 200 million. There are also Christians and others. Do you think that we're going to see some type of reaction from within India, or does pressure have to come from outside?
I think the pressure has to come from outside and inside combined. The reality is that they have, I mean, as I mentioned, Gujarat massacre was a sort of an exercise to see if they could get away with it. It happened at the time that they weren't in absolute power, but nevertheless, with all the evidence which was there, and we presented an extensive report on it from IHRC, but nothing was done. They got away with it. They're getting away with it in Kashmir. And they're getting away with all these demonization publicly from very high up within the Indian society. They're getting away with it. That is really what makes it very clear that, you know, we are at a very, very dangerous sort of time. Something needs to be done urgently, internationally and nationally. And I'm afraid we can't hold our breath and wait for the OIC to do anything. They've never done anything for anyone. But I think we need to sort of expose what is happening is going to be creating one of the greatest sort of genocide, which, you know, which has taken place. And until unless something will be done urgently, and I emphasize urgently, then we are well already in the way of that genocide, and all the preparation for it, all the tests, and all the you know, the situation of Kashmir and the change of the laws against the constitution and so forth, they're all in place for this fascist system to go into the full scale and create that sort of genocide. And we need to really ring the alarm bells all over and ring it in such a way that this sort of genocide, that level in a place like India, is going to be so devastating, not just for Indian Muslims, but for everyone in the region and beyond.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Zafar Bangash, from the Institute, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and out of Qesh, lucky you, Masood Shahjadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.